Few leaders finish well. My privilege this last year to run across a very interesting book, which I would highly recommend. You can find it on the book table out there. It's called Making of a Leader by Bobby Clinton or Robert Clinton. My understanding is he's the only person in the country who chairs a leadership development department at a seminary. He's at Fuller Seminary. I'm sure there will be other ones through the years, but he's kind of at that level, a sort of a pioneer in the whole subject of leadership development. And this is not your ordinary how-to book. It's more of a conceptual book that deals with the process that a leader goes through to develop himself or herself. So what he does is he enables you to go back at the beginning and just trace your life all the way through and see what God has done along the way and give you an idea of where you are and what lies before you and what you can do to continue to grow and develop as a leader. It's an excellent book. One other book while I'm on the subject of books that I would recommend, we only have 12 of them. It's a book by Fred Smith called Learning to Lead. Fred Smith is he's not a pastor, he's not a seminary Bible school graduate, he's a businessman in Texas. And he didn't write his first book in this is his second book, but he didn't write his first book until he was 70 years old. So he's no spring chicken. And he speaks from a lot of in depth, experience in the business world, and he has the opportunity of traveling around quite a bit. Those of you that read Leadership Magazine have seen some articles by Fred Smith. There are 12 copies of these in the bookstore that we had specially ordered, so if this is a book that's of interest to you, you can pick that up. The reason I mentioned Bobby Clinton, you will see a lot of things coming with his name under it in the years to come. He writes a lot of papers, sends them out and has people read them and look at them, and then eventually they become books. I had the privilege of spending a half a day with Bobby several months ago, and he gave me a paper that I'm sure will be part of a book later on. In that paper, which is the substance of the introduction, he studied between 100 and 300 leaders that he could identify in the Bible. He chose to focus on 100 of them that there was enough information that he could make some decisions, draw some conclusions about. And this was the conclusion that he came to. On those out of the 100, on those on which there was enough information available, he discovered that less than 30% of them had finished well. Now, these 100 leaders were both Old Testament as well as New Testament leaders. Only 30% had finished well. Clinton's definition of having finished well means that they were walking with God personally at the end of their lives, and probably contributed to God's purposes at some high realized level of potential. So two things. When they got all the way down at the end of their lives, they were still walking with God. And number two, that they had contributed to God's purposes for their lives. Now when you stop and think of the fact that less than 30% had finished well, and these are biblical leaders, that's kind of a scary thought. So the issue that I would like to deal with today is what can we do to be among the people who will finish well? I mean, I personally can't think of a more important thing to hear at the end of my life than to have God say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." I can't think of a bigger tragedy to get to the end of my life and find out that it was not well done, that I fall into the percentage of those who did not finish well. So we have 3 points that we want to cover today. This is by no means exhaustive, but I think in these three you'll see 3 very key areas that are important to give attention to if you will be among those who finish well. The first one is developing yourself to your full potential, becoming a learner all the days of your life. There's a secular book out of the market simply entitled Leaders. And in the last issue that I got from Frank Tillipaw from Denver, he had a little one sheet, both sides, with little tidbits of this and that and the other thing. But he also had a quote from this book entitled Leaders. And I'm reading from that book. When we asked our 90 leaders about the personal qualities they needed to run their organizations, they never mentioned charisma, or dressing for success, or time management, or any of the other glib formulas that pass for wisdom in the popular press. But above all, they talked about learning. Leaders are perpetual learners. Learning is the essential fuel for the leader. So I think really this is the place where it has to start, that in your mind and in my mind, I make a decision that all of my life I'm going to be a learner. I'm not going to plateau, not going to rest on my laurels, on yesterday's experiences. Leroy Iams for many years used to say that yesterday's home runs don't win tomorrow's ball games. You can't count on what you used to be or what you used to study or what you used to know or what you used to do. The question is, what are you learning today? What new thoughts, what new ideas, what new horizons, what new vistas is God leading you through today and in the future? I do a lot of reading, both sacred as well as secular, and I mix it all together. So as I go through today, you're going to hear a little bit of both. I read a statement that Mary Kay Ash, she's the lady that gives away all the free pink Cadillacs, and she made this statement that has been extremely motivational to me. It's on your outline. Most people go to their graves with their music still unplayed. I don't know how that grabs you, but that really motivates me. Because when I read that, I thought that God places inside of every one of us music. Now, your music is not the same as mine, and mine's not the same as yours. Some of us have concertos and jazz bands, classical music, pop, rock. There's all kinds of music. But God put music inside of each one of us, and the whole purpose is that music would be played. But for a variety of reasons, we get to the end of our lives and find out that the music never came out. We stifled it, we ignored it, we were inhibited, we were fearful, we were insecure, whatever we were, the music was not played. And so I told God, God, do whatever you need to do with me, but I want every single note that you have placed in me to be played before I die. And so that's been ringing in my mind for quite a few years. I love the story that Howard Hendricks tells about a professor at Dallas Seminary that he sat under. He remarked that very frequently he would go very early in the morning to school. He walked. And he would go by the house of this professor. And early in the morning, while it was still dark, he would see the light on in the professor's study and he'd be plugging away at his books. And then it was also his custom to stay late at the seminary and come home in the evening when it was dark, and he would see the same light on this professor, in this professor's study. So one day he had a conversation with him and he said, you know, you've been at this seminary a long time. You think by now you'd have it all figured out. You've read all the books there is to read. You pretty well know where you're coming from. But yet in the morning, early in the morning when it's still dark, I see you studying. And late in the evening when I'm heading back from the seminary, I see you studying. Why do you do this? What motivates you? And this was the classical remark. I would much rather have my students drink from a running spring than a stagnant pool. So one of the things that keeps that spring running and keeps it full with fresh water is the fact that you've decided that you're not going to plateau and level out as a learner, but that you make a decision that you're going to be a lifelong learner. Some verses from Proverbs that you can write in there on your notes. One of my favorites is Proverbs 18:15. And in the Living Bible, it says, the intelligent man is always open to new ideas. In fact, he looks for them. I see two things in this verse. I see not only an openness, but an eagerness. I mean, this person is not just sitting waiting for ideas to come. He's like a tiger on the prowl. He or she is looking and taking the initiative and demonstrates an eagerness to discover new things. Proverbs 24:32. I saw and considered it well. I looked upon it and received instruction. No one needs to remind us that we live in a very fast-paced society. It's getting faster and faster. I had a very unpleasant surprise this last week. I went into a Denny's restaurant. It's been quite a while since I've been in Denny's restaurant. And they put a stopwatch on the table when we sat down. Then we found out that when we opened the menu up, there were several entrees on the menu that had this little stopwatch emblem on it. And what it was that when you made your order, she would hit that stopwatch. And if it got to 10 minutes before your order came back to the table, you got it free. And I thought, this has got to be the epitome of idiocy. You know, it used to be that if we don't serve you in 15 minutes, we'll desert you for free. And, you know, all that. Now, to make sure that it's pretty symbolically clear, the dumb watch is sitting right there on the table. I watched this waitress. I said, don't you get nervous, you know, with that stopwatch running? Oh, she says, yeah. When she got back in 6 minutes, I was impressed. Maybe they're in the whole competition with all the fast food. I wonder now if pretty soon they're going to be on roller skates or on conveyor belts, giving it to you in 4 minutes instead of 10 minutes. But all of this precipitates an attitude that we're always in a hurry. We eat fast, we talk fast, we drive fast. We're trying to keep upping the pace all the time, which mitigates against just stopping and observing and looking. That's why I like Proverb 24:32. I saw and considered it well. I looked upon it and received instruction. So now you don't have to read books anymore. If you travel a lot, you just get the tape, pop it in your cassette player, and off you go down the freeway. And you can hear all the latest whatever while you're doing something else. I'm wondering if it's going to get to the place pretty soon where people don't sit down and read books anymore. Maybe they pipe it into your head while you're sleeping so you can get two things accomplished at once. But I think what we need to do is just slow down. Think more, read, meditate, look around, and observe. And that's part of learning.
Don't those two things often play against each other? I mean, it's desire and hunger to grow and learn versus slowing down. And that's the reason we pop the tapes in there. I mean, sometimes it's not just to fill it up with input. It is to do that.
Right. Maybe the fact is we're trying to learn too much in too short a space of time.
We're in an information-saturated society.
Yeah, it's a good point. And it's not just the information. It's not just getting it all in there. You have to have the time to think about it. And I wonder if you're driving down the freeway listening to a tape, if you can think as well as you were sitting quietly and had allowed enough time to have a piece of paper in front of you, you could write some thoughts down, pray about it. I mean, you've got to concentrate on traffic. You're thinking about where you're going. And it might be information to just keep filling our brains. I remember a commercial that Winston Cigarettes had years ago. It said, are you smoking more and enjoying it less? And sometimes we can be learning more and enjoying it less because we're just cramming our heads full with more and more information. But we need to stop and think and reflect and meditate. And when we go very fast, we can miss some things. Have you ever had the experience of having been in a situation that you've been in many, many times and everything was so familiar around you that it just didn't register anymore? I remember being in a home with a couple once, and the train came by. The train was more than 50 feet outside the living room window, and this thing came rumbling by, and the cups were, jumping up and down on the table. When it went by, I turned to the couple, and I said, boy, that must be something, having a train track that close to your house. They didn't even hear it. They are so used to having that train go by out there, it doesn't even register anymore. Well, I heard it, about rattle my head deep inside. Have you ever had somebody remark about a painting or something on a wall or something in your home that you'd long since forgotten had been there? I mean, if you were sitting with your back to something on your wall and said, well, that's a beautiful painting, do you think you could tell them what was hanging there without turning around and looking at it? It's been there for so long that it doesn't register anymore. Sometimes we can read the same passages of Scripture and listen to the same thoughts, but we've heard it so many times it doesn't make an impact. We don't see anything new. We don't observe anything different. We're just going over the same terrain, the same territory. Bible reading can become like that. We don't see it with fresh eyes and new insight. We're just rehashing the same thing over and over. And we've actually stopped learning. We're just reshuffling the same ideas, but we're not breaking any new ground. Another one is not Proverb, but it's from Ecclesiastes 4:13. Better is a youth poor and wise than a king old and foolish who no longer knows how to take advice. That's part of learning, being open to have someone correct you or give you advice or point out something wrong. I was talking with a fellow just this week here in town that I know about the pastor in their church, and there's some real problems there. People are leaving. They're in financial difficulties. And this gentleman is an elder at the church. So I said, well, can anyone talk to the pastor and explain some of these things? his remark was sad. He said, no, not really. He's very defensive. Anytime you point anything out or try to show him anything that maybe we could change this or maybe we could do this differently, immediately his defenses go up. He's got an explanation. He's got a rationale for why they're doing what they're doing or why they can't change it. He has ceased to learn. Quite a few years ago, I was presenting an illustration to a non-Christian that I spent many months learning how to perfect this illustration so I could communicate to somebody who didn't believe. So I painstakingly drew it all out. I was very proud I did it all right according to the book, just exactly the way I'd learned. And this non-Christian looked at that illustration and said, that's terrible. He said, that's a poor illustration. And immediately I thought, well, wait a minute now. I'm the one who's perfected this thing. You're not even a Christian. You're going to tell me something's wrong with it. He said, you want to know what's wrong with that illustration? I wasn't sure I wanted to answer that question. And he proceeded to tell me why it wouldn't communicate to people like him and what was wrong with it. And he took it and he redesigned it right there before my eyes. There was my opportunity to learn from the very person that I was trying to communicate with when he told me that it just wasn't a good illustration. And he was right. Better is a youth, poor and wise, than a leader, old and famous, who no longer knows how to take advice. That's part of the learning process. One last one, Proverbs 5, 12, and 13. Once again, in the Living Bible. Oh, if only I had listened. If only I had not demanded my own way. Why wouldn't I take advice? Why was I so stupid? That's real living. That's 5, 12, and 13. Why wouldn't I listen? Why did I demand my own way, my own thinking, my own opinions? Why wouldn't I take advice? Why was I so stupid? I like the statement that the founder of Hewlett Packard said. He said, don't emulate, innovate. And sometimes in the learning process, we tend to just look somewhere else where people are successful and try to copy what they're doing. Well, it worked over there at Willow Creek, or it works over there at Saddleback. So let's just take the model, do what they're doing, and transplant it over here, and then we'll be successful. I'm not sure that that's the way to do it. But to look at the principles, what can we learn from what they're doing, what can we gather from the way they think, from their approach, from the research that they did, and let's innovate and figure out how to apply what we're learning to our situation. In fact, I was back at Willow Creek and went through that week-long seminar that they give back there. And I don't know how many times during that week they told us over and over, don't take what we do and go back home and try to copy it. Try to see the principles, the concepts, the attitude that's behind it. And then you ask yourselves, what can we learn from what they've done there, and what can we principle-wise incorporate and then innovate in our own situation? So don't emulate, but innovate.
It's one of those fond of saying, milk all the cows you can, but then make your own butter.
Good way to say it. Milk all the cows you can, and then make your own butter. Gather all the ideas you can, get all the principles, and then take it all and create for you in your situation what God is leading you to do. Quite a few years ago, I ran into some tapes that I borrowed from somebody. There were some tapes, and I've since forgotten the gentleman's name. It's been so long now. But he was the genius behind the Disney concepts. It wasn't always Walt Disney that came up with all those ideas, but there was a fellow who kind of did a lot of his thinking for him. And he shared a quote that I've never seen anywhere else that Walt Disney said that I really enjoy. And it's in your notes. The more you're like yourself, the less you're like anyone else. And that's what makes you unique. And that's part of learning. Being true to yourself, true to who you are, true to who God's made you, your capacity, your abilities, your gifting. And then to maximize your potential. Not maximize somebody else's potential in your body. The more you're like yourself, the less you're like anyone else, and that's what makes you unique. And I was presumptuous enough to add something to what Disney said, and I kept it going, and I said this, the more you're like everyone else, the less you're like yourself, and that's what makes you average.
Yeah.
So if you want to be unique, don't try to be like somebody else or model another church. Be like yourself. Want to repeat it? The more you're like everybody else, the less you're like yourself. And that's what makes you average. So you are unique. And in that uniqueness, the great privilege and the great joy in life is to reach your potential within your own parameters and your own uniqueness. Because if you don't become you, nobody else will. I mean, there's only one you, and God put that music inside of you, and He wants to hear it played right up to your full potential. I believe we need a lot of things, but two things we definitely need. We need courage, and we need curiosity. We need courage to take risks, to frolic in new territory. We need curiosity to see the new in the old, the different in the usual. And that just doesn't happen in this fast-paced, fast-thinking society without time just to meditate and reflect and observe. By walking slower, by thinking more deeply, by praying more and asking God for creative ideas. So there are at least two sources of our learning that I want to spend a couple of minutes on. One is to learn from other people. The best thing that I can do when I'm with someone else is to keep my mouth shut and just ask a lot of questions and listen. Warren Sandy shared the story once when he was on a plane with a very well-known, successful person. Now, Warren is no dummy. I mean, he's been around the block a few times. He was president of the Navigators for 30 years. I mean, he's got a tremendous amount of experience and insight. But Warren said the whole time he was on that flight, all he did was kept asking questions of this gentleman. And this gentleman just kept expounding, and Warren was jotting notes down and thinking and penetrating and so forth. When the flight was over and the two of them departed, the gentleman turned to Lauren and thanked him, said it was the best conversation he'd had in years. And Lauren was the richer for it. Now that's a hard discipline for those of us that have the gift of talking. If we're a teacher, a pastor, a preacher, often when we get together we find ourselves talking and sharing and so forth. And one of the ways to learn, of course, is just to keep asking more and more questions. Well, then what happened after that? And why did you do this? And what did you learn from that? And if you had it, you know, just keep asking questions and keep getting more and more information and just listen and think and analyze. I regret the times when I've been with some very interesting people and I've just blathered on because I was so excited. You know, it's like Peter, when he gets excited, he just talks instead of listening. So one of the things I pray regularly for myself is that God would make me a better and a better listener. So learn from others. Well, what kinds of others? Whether those people that work for you, if you have responsibility, you can learn from the people that you would think are under you, although they really aren't. But the people who work for you, if you're a pastor, you have a staff, or you have elders, if you're a chairman of the board, or a Sunday school superintendent, you have other people that work for you. Does it ever occur to us that we can learn from those people? Is it always that they learn from us because we are the boss? Do you ever ask your subordinates questions about what they're learning or if they have any advice to offer you? I've been in the habit for several years when I have an evaluation with somebody who works for me, that when I get all the way down to the end, I say, now I have evaluated you. I've evaluated your job, your performance, your goals. Now it's your chance. What would you like to see changed in me as far as me being your boss? What could I do differently? What don't you like about the way I do my job or the way I handle you or treat you? And give them an opportunity to respond back. Quite often they're kind of shocked. You mean you really want me to? Yeah, I really do. If you could change the way you and I work together or our relationship, what would you suggest? It's at the bottom of every evaluation I do. And I mean it. Tell me what I need to do to make both of us work better together to accomplish more, and I'll do everything I can to do that. Learning from the people that you consider working for you. Then learn from your superiors. We fear our superiors, but do we ask up? Do we ask questions? Or are we very, very careful and selective in what we do? Or do we just lay ourselves, what would you like to tell me about my job? How can I improve what I'm doing? Our pastor. There's a lot of things I admire about him, but one of the things that I admire is his openness and willingness to learn. We were together just the morning before I left on this trip in a hotel room, and one of the questions that was asked of all of us was to give a critique on his ability to deliver and to teach and to minister in the services. And he wanted any mannerisms that he had picked up, if he's in the habit of saying certain things that have lost their meaning, if he's got nervous gestures, and we let him have a bundle. He never defended himself. He never tried to explain it. He just sat there with a notepad, writing it all down. And yes, you're right on that. I have slipped into that habit, and I appreciate your comment on that. And I thought, that's amazing. I don't know too many pastors that would be willing to lay themselves open and ask people to give them critique about their... I mean, he's been pastor at that church for 7 years in the ministry, probably for 10 or 15, and to still have that openness, to want somebody to correct, to point things out, to give him suggestions. Mike is a lifelong learner. Learn from your peers. Do you compete with your peers or do you learn from them? Can you go to someone who has the same type of job that you have and ask questions about what they're doing, or do you feel intimidated that they are more successful than you are? You don't want to learn anything from them. If you do, it's so you can pass them or do better than they do. Well, let me add another one on this, peers. Try to learn from peers that are outside of your normal circle that you run in. If you are in a certain denomination, whether you be Baptist or Assembly of God or EV Free, find somebody who's out of, in a totally different area, a different denomination or a parachurch group who has similar responsibilities to yours. Get together every once in a while with this individual and ask them. See what you can learn from them. We found out in the Navigators for many years that we tended to move just in Navigator circles. We read Navigator magazines. We went to Navigator conferences. We all memorized the same verses. We all had the same quiet time. And it was very unusual for us to ever go totally outside of a Navigator context to another conference or read books that the Baptists were reading or that somebody else was reading. So we all kind of became clones to a great degree. You could almost, when you listened to a Navigator speaker and they were making their points, you could almost tell ahead of time what verses they were going to use, because we all used the same verses. And we all used the same illustrations and the stories. I don't know why it took us so long to figure out that we needed some fresh springs from somewhere else. And now it's a different story. We bring people in from all different kinds of disciplines. We bring presidents of seminaries in and pastors from different churches and denominations and sit and pick their brains and ask questions. We even, would you believe, ask people to criticize us as an organization. What's wrong with the Navigators? What do we need to change? What do you find offensive about the way we do things? And boy, we got an earful. That's all part of the process of being lifelong learners. Two verses on learning from others. Proverbs 13:20. He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. Pick some wise men. Not the ones that confirm your prejudices, but the ones that will challenge your thinking or stretch you or disagree with you. Maybe even cross over doctrinal lines to people who you consider liberal and see if you can learn anything from what's going on over there. I'm not saying that you buy everything that you hear, but just to be stretched and pulled beyond your normal, comfortable range. Another verse in Proverbs on learning from others is a very familiar one, 27:17. Iron sharpens iron. So one man or one woman sharpens the countenance of another. Do you have anybody that you get together with regularly that provides that kind of sharpening for you? Or do you kind of stay with people that you're familiar with? You all feel nice and comfortable. You all know where you're coming from. Bust out of that. Take a risk. Do something different. The second area, in addition to other people, I think we can learn a great deal is in reading. But once again, we tend to read in the same general area instead of breaking into new territory. That's one problem. Another problem with the reading is that we tend to read for other people instead of for ourselves. Especially for those of you that are pastors or teachers, you tend to read in order to prepare to give to other people. But I think we need to do reading for ourselves, to continue to stretch and develop ourselves. It should be a balance that, yes, I need to read a certain degree in order to keep up with things so that I can communicate adequately and have things to prepare that are relevant and biblically based. but I also need to read to continue to expand and develop myself. And we need to find a balance between the two. Just a couple of days ago, I did a very simple calculation. And that is, if I were to spend 20 minutes a day, I'm talking about in addition to what you already might be doing, just find 20 minutes somewhere. Just turn off one of those half an hour programs that you're addicted to and decide to read for 20 minutes of that half an hour. But do it on a regular basis, 7 days a week, 20 minutes a day. If you take about a minute and a half to read a page, which is about average, your average page in a book like this, that would be a little on the slow side. Most of you read much faster than that. By just reading 20 minutes a day, you could read 18 250-page books in a year, in addition to what you might already be doing. You say, well, I already read quite a bit, but I'm not reading much for myself. Well, just etch out 20 minutes a day, if you're consistent at it, in a year you could read 18 books in some particular area that you want to broaden yourself in. Now, 20 minutes is not a long time. But the key is to do it consistently and regularly. Find a spot during the day, whether it be in the morning or whether it be during lunch hour, in the evening, before you go to bed, and just get in the habit of consistently reading. Let me give you a principle here that I discovered several years ago that's been very helpful to me. You might want to take it down word for word. The accumulated effect of small things over an extended period of time. That's the principle. The accumulated effect of small things over an extended period of time. It works in just about everything. Memorizing verses, you don't have to memorize a ton, just memorize one or two a week, but do it for a long time. I listened to a Ron Blue tape not too long ago. He said, the bottom line in all finances is very simple. Spend less than you make and do it for a long time. I don't know why the government can't figure that out. Read 20 minutes a day. It works in exercise. It's much better if you exercise 3 days a week for 30 minutes and just do it week after week after week after week than if you take 3 hours once a month and exercise. It's just not the same. It's that consistency and regularity that produces the fruit over a long period of time. By the way, it works the other way around too with calories. You don't have to eat a lot of extra calories. If you just eat consistently a few hundred calories more than you need over a period of time, you'll notice the difference. The funny thing about it is, which I tend to ask God about when I get to heaven, why it doesn't work the other way, why it doesn't go off as slow as it comes. You know, when you're trying to lose it, it takes forever. Well, when you put it on, it seems like it happens over Christmas. You can put on 20 pounds over Christmas, but try to lose 20 pounds in the same number of days. And I thought, God, that's not fair. Well, you messed up somewhere here. You know, it's not consistent. The accumulated effect of small things over an extended period of time. Then this quote down at the bottom by Robert Clinton. Effective leaders maintain a learning posture all their lives. An inflexible spirit with regards to learning is almost a sure precursor to finishing so-so or poorly. One more thought, and then I'm going to give you a chance to respond, to make a comment. Learning is a matter of collecting ideas, and you never know where you're going to get them. I always carry something to write with, no matter where I go. Even in the bathroom, I walk sometimes, not every time, but walk in with this. Because an idea will come and somehow it can just escape. I run and I get some of my best ideas when I'm running. The problem is I can't remember them, keep them in my mind until the time I get home. I'm like that golfer. You know, that yeah, he saw it, but he forgot. And the older I get, the harder it is to remember. But ideas are precious. Sometimes I'll go to a conference and for a whole week it's worth it for me. If I come home with two or three ideas that I can do something with, it's worth $300 or $400 in a whole week of my time. Sometimes I'll read a book and I'll only get one key idea out of that book. I went to this seminar in Washington, D.C. 3 or 4 years ago, and the one thing I got from that whole conference was the principle I just shared with you, but that's been worth its weight in gold. I have had numerous occasions to apply the accumulated effect of small things over an extended period of time. And as soon as I share it with somebody, they see the application immediately. And it has a tendency to motivate. So this thought about ideas. Treat ideas like newborn babies. Treat them tenderly. They can get killed pretty quickly. Treat them gently. They can be bruised in infancy. Treat them respectfully. They could be the most valuable things that ever came into your life. Treat them protectively. Don't let them get away. Treat them antiseptically. Don't let them get infected with the germs of negative thought. Treat them responsibly. Respond. Act. Do something with them. A leader is a lifelong learner. Develop yourself to your full potential. Learning. Okay, I'm going to stop here. Give you a chance to ask a question, make a comment. And if you do, since this is being taped, just step up to one of those two microphones so they can pick it up on there. Make a comment or share your own experience. Ask a question, whatever you care to do. I'll give you an opportunity to respond now to this first part. Don't be bashful. Jump up there. Okay, if there are no questions or comments, we'll move on. Part number two. Develop your ability to hear from God. And this has to do with listening. Once again, for those of us who are teachers or pastors, there's a great tendency here to listen for things to share with somebody else. And I can't stress the importance enough of getting things for your own soul. If you keep dipping into that well and pretty soon it's dry and there are just leaves blowing around at the bottom, you don't have anything to give anyone else. I mean, you can have all the great commentaries in the world, but the greatest thing you give someone else is your life and your own experience with God. So we need to keep listening and hearing from God. Now in Mark chapter 1, there's that story that Jesus was busy all day long. And it said, in the evening, people gathered at the door, in verses 33 and 34, and he healed them and took care of them. And then somewhere between verse 34 and 35, he went to bed. But we don't know what time he went to bed, whether it was 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock or 2 or 3. Who knows how long those people waited around at the house for his healing touch, for his encouragement, for his words of wisdom. But Mark 1:35 starts off very early in the morning. Before it was day, he went out and departed into a quiet, solitary, lonely place and prayed. And immediately after Mark 1:35, the disciples wake up and they don't find him, so they run around. Where did he go? You know, they're out trying to find him. And finally they locate him and they in a sense reprimand him for having left the house and taking that time alone and mentioning the fact that all the people needed him. And I've drawn some conclusions from that passage of Scripture from Mark 1:35. The first point on your outline there is that that time alone for him was a sublime priority. Sure, he was tired. Sure, he was busy. Sure, there were things to do. When I read through that passage, don't know of anyone who has busier days than Jesus Christ had. He had every right to sleep in, every right to be tired. But he was still up and still out by himself to get that needed time. And I think it has to start right there. It's got to be a priority with me and with you. I remember when I was a young Christian and it came to my attention about the whole concept of a quiet time. And I've been a Christian for 30 years now. And I made a decision that I was going to make it a priority the first part of my day. And I had a job at that time where I went to work at 6 o'clock in the morning. I didn't get up at 6, I started work at 6. So I had to get up 4:30 in the morning in order to have my breakfast, make my lunch, and have some time with God. That necessitated my obviously having to go to bed a little bit earlier. I was at that time in a young people's group, and there was one girl in the group that made a big deal about it when I would leave early. You know, when everybody was having fun and it was just getting warmed up, and I was about ready to sneak out the back door around 9 o'clock to get home and get to bed because I knew I wanted to get up to have that time. I was a very young Christian. I knew that I needed to build those habits and be faithful. But she somehow managed to always see me. And she would say, there goes Dave Kraft. If he doesn't get to bed by 9:30, he's going to turn into a pumpkin. Where do you suppose she got that from? Cinderella. And, you know, it hurt a little bit because I wasn't going to try to explain why I needed, because everybody in that group didn't go to work at 6 o'clock in the morning. But I was glad that God helped me develop those habits of making it a sublime priority. And it's got to be that. I mean, there's always the demands. There's always the telephone. There's always the letters. And the devil's always there to give you 100 reasons why you don't have time today. But if in your mind and in your heart before God it's a sublime priority, you'll be the better off for it in the long run. Once again, it's the accumulated effect of small things over an extended period of time. The second point, a specific time. Brian Tracy, who is a well-known speaker and communicator, makes this simple statement that what gets measured gets done. What gets measured gets done. And I have found in my life that when I set a time, whether it's from 5:30 to 6 or 6 to 6:30, whatever it is, but I put it down specific time, somehow it manages to happen. But I don't know how many people I've talked to that say, well, you know, I try to have a quiet time sometime in the morning before I go to work, and you know what happens? It doesn't get done. Some people have referred to it as an appointment with God. How many of you have read My Heart, Christ's Home by Bob Munger? And you know, in that book, he talks about a meeting with God. Remember, he's coming down the stairs, if you recall the book, and Jesus is waiting for him there in the parlor, and he starts to zip out, and he says, have you been waiting here all this time? He says, I've been here every morning. We had an agreement, didn't we, that we would meet together in the morning, and he's really embarrassed that he's been kind of sneaking out and ignoring it. And there's all sorts of legitimate reasons. Well, you know, it's kind of demanding at work. And the only time I could find to set up this appointment was this morning with this person, so I'm just going to hop over it. I'm not saying legalistically every day, you know, for 30 years. But the habit of your life is to have a specific time. And I'm not saying it has to be in the morning. Some of you are night people, and you come alive about 1 o'clock in the morning. Whenever it is, make it a specific time, an appointment, a date with God. Like you make a date with your spouse or a friend or your children or anyone else. A specific time. Then a secret place. One of the reasons it doesn't happen or doesn't happen with the effect that it should is because we don't have a place where we can be alone. Was it a coincidence that Jesus left the house? I don't think so. He needed to be alone. It's hard to have a quiet time when all kinds of things are going on. The radio, the TV, the people. I have had some very unusual places to have quiet times. I have sat in laundry rooms with waste paper baskets turned upside down because it's the only place I could find. I have sat in the car, out in the yard or out in the garage with a blanket wrapped around me. When I lived overseas, when it was very, very cold in the morning, I used to go down in the basement and sit right next to the furnace and wrap myself in a blanket because it was the only place in the house where they couldn't find me. When I was in the Army, I really had to stretch my imagination because they would literally skin you alive if you got up early and turned the lights on and, you know, woke anybody up. So I went into the bathroom, went into one of the stalls, closed the door. And when I was in the Army, that's where I had my quiet time. Nobody disturb me. Nobody's going to come knocking on the door or bother you. And I was alone. Whatever it takes, find a secret place. It talks about that place in reference to Jesus, that it was a solitary place. In some translations, it's translated a lonely place. Just to get alone, a secret place. And then lastly, a special plan. What are you going to do? You don't want to waste your time there trying to figure out what to do. And there are lots of plans on the market out there. So figure out some type of a plan. What will you do? Where are you going to read? Do you have a plan for your prayer? What kinds of things will you pray about? So you just don't sit there and let your mind wander and you don't have any idea. So I found those to be real essentials that help me. A sublime priority, a specific time, a secret place, a special plan. Now, I've got a few words down there that are my plan, what I do. And I'll just give them to you. You can take what you want from it. The first word is pray. Then read. Think. Write. Worship. Pray. And journal. I pray before I start, just that God would quiet my heart, that He would help me concentrate, that He would help me see new things and old verses. I mean, how many times can you read through the gospel and still try to find something new and refreshing? I found a thought just 3 days ago in the gospel of Mark that I never saw before. Tremendously encouraging thought that never occurred to me. And I've read that story over and over and over again. But by God's grace, I saw something new in the old. Something different in the usual. And I think God wants to do that for us. It's the living Word of God. Then read. Don't read so much that you don't have time to think. Some of these programs have you reading so much that you're spending all your time just dashing through trying to get to the end of the program that you never have time to think about it. And I think that's where the blessing is, in the thinking and meditation. So pray, read, think, and then write something down so you don't forget it. You can write in your Bible. You can have a piece of paper or some type of a thing where you just jot down a word or two for yourself to help you remember. And then worship. Spend some time just worshiping God for what He's shown you, for who He is. And then pray again over the things that He's shown you. Pray them into your life. Pray for grace to remember them, to apply them. Or grace to see even deeper truths in what you've discovered. And then journaling is something I started just last year. Just to keep a daily journal of what He's showing me. And basically my journal is sort of a prayer journal. I just kind of put my thoughts into a prayer of what I've learned this morning and what He's been communicating to me. Psalm 73, 16-17 is an interesting verse. When I tried to understand, it was oppressive to me. I better look it up. That's not exactly the way it is. 73:16-17. When I tried to understand all this, it was oppressive to me. Till I entered the sanctuary of God, then I understood. I tell you, all the board meetings and all the discussions and pastoral staff meetings can never be a substitute for spending time alone and having God clear something up. One of my favorite stories on this is about a fellow from another country that had pulled into a gas station to make a phone call. He saw the telephone booth. It was at night. And he walked over to the booth to make his call, but of course it was pitch dark. He couldn't see anything. He saw a light in the ceiling of this phone booth, and so he started to walk around the outside looking for the light switch. Obviously, if there's a light, there's a switch, right? So he went all around. He looked from the ground up, put his hands up and down the sides. He couldn't find anything. He walked in the booth and looked all around everywhere he could look, and he was just dumbfounded. You know, these crazy Americans, they build a phone booth, they put a light in it, but they forgot to put the switch. And so it turned out that while he was doing all of this, there was a family that had pulled into this gas station to tank up, and they had a son about 9 years old that was watching this gentleman. And so he walked over to him and he said, "Mister, you have to go in and close the door in order for the light to come on." So the person walked in, and sure enough, as soon as he shut the door to the phone booth, the light came on. I thought it's a beautiful illustration. Sometimes when it's dark and I don't understand, I'm confused, it doesn't help much to rack my brain and to keep reproducing on paper what I've thought already, but somehow to get alone with God and begin to pray and close the door, then, as Psalm 73:16-17, then I understood. Mark 4:34 is interesting in this regard. It says, "With many parables he spoke the word to him, and when he was alone, he expounded all things to his disciples." As you recall, when you read through the Gospels, you see over and over again afterwards when they went to the house or after the multitudes left, they asked him questions. What does this mean? Or why this? Or how is that? And that's when he explained some of the deeper things. Not in the rush and bush of the general teaching or when the multitude was there, but after everything had settled down and when they were alone with him, then they got the deeper understanding. And I think it's true for us. That's why it's so important. I want to share something with you that's not on your outline. How many of you have ever heard of the name Frank Gabelline? Does it ring a bell with anybody? Okay, quite a few of you. He, for many years, was the president of the Stony Brook School in Long Island. He wrote a highly regarded volume on Christian education in a democracy. For 3 years, he was the co-editor of Christianity Today. He was also the stylist for the New International Version of the Bible, which so many of us enjoy. He was, in addition to that, the general editor of the 12-volume expository Bible commentary. When he was 80 years old, I don't even know if he's still alive, but when he was 80, he was in a certain situation and he was asked a question, which I thought was a very fascinating question. "What counsel would you wish to pass on to the next generation of Christian leaders?" Now, that's quite a question. Supposing you were asked to stand up before a few thousand Christian leaders, up-and-coming potential leaders, if somebody asked you, "Why don't you tell us, what advice would you pass on to this next generation of Christian leaders?" I think his answer was totally unexpected. And I quote, and this is what he said, "Maintain, at all costs, a daily time of scripture reading and prayer." As I look back, I see that the most formative influence in my life and thought has been my daily contact with Scripture for over 60 years. Now here's a man who was well-read, well-respected, author, lecturer, and of all the books that he'd ever read and all the people he's talked to and all the papers he's written and every great thought that's ever passed through his mind, doesn't it strike you as being very fascinating that the advice that he would pass on is his daily quiet time over 60 years has been the most formative influence in his life? To me, that says it all. I ran across another interesting gentleman. And the reason I enjoy some of these fellows that are 70 and 80 years old is because they've seen it all. They've been through it. And it's once again an opportunity. I feel sorry for young people to think, well, you know, those guys are over the hill, what do they know? You know, they're living in a bygone generation. And one of the mistakes we make in this country is to retire people at 65. I can't find a Bible verse on that. Why people get put on the shelf and get their gold watch when they're 65. Between 65 and however long that they might live could be some of the best years of their lives and the privilege and opportunity that we have to learn from them. Well, there was such a gentleman, probably not as well known in Christian circles because he was a politician. His name was Dr. Charles Malik. He was the former president of the United Nations General Assembly. He was president of the Security Council and without question one of the greatest Christian statesmen of the 20th century. He was a founder of the United Nations and author of the Declaration of Human Rights. He was president of the Security Council for a number of years. I have a missionary friend in Southeast Asia who was discipling a young man. This young man came back to the United States and had the privilege of traveling with Dr. Malik for an entire summer. He had his appointments at the United Nations and with presidents and congressmen and world leaders, and they basically just went all over the country. He carried his bags, he made his hotel reservations, he ran any errands he could for him, just became a personal valet for an entire summer. When the summer was all over, and they were about to depart, and with the thought that he might never see this man again, he asked him a question. But prior to the question, this was his observation. We spent hours discussing the atmosphere in a crisis, the immense demands on a leader's time, the pressures from all sides, the growing threat and danger of nuclear war, the degeneration of Western civilization. And I asked Dr. Malik, how in the midst of all of this chaos do you maintain your own sense of values and priorities of what's right and what's wrong? How do you find meaningful solutions to the chaotic times in which we live? The young man said, I'll never forget his answer. Going over to his still unpacked suitcase, he ever so carefully took out a book. The pages were loose. Some of them fell out. It was beat up and worn and looked terrible. Yet he handled it like it was the greatest of all treasures. And as I sat down, I could tell that that beat up old book was his Bible. I asked him if I could hold it. And as I turned to page after page in the Old and the New Testament, there was hardly any more room on any page for more writing. Every page was well worn and well studied. I asked him how often he had to get a new Bible, thinking that the Bible on my lap was at least 20 years old. He responded, about every 2 years. Wearing out a Bible every 2 years by studying it. I know what his answer would be to my original question. He simply said, you must get to know the author of this book and put into practice everything he tells you to do. As a college student, and here it is with sublime priority, as a college student, he established his priorities, and down through the years, his first priority has been to begin each day alone with God and His Word. No exceptions permitted, ever. Now, how many of us wear out a Bible, even at 30 or 40 or 50 years of age, every 2 years by studying it? It's no wonder he was able to cope and deal. And the reason so many of us, not only here, but outside of this room, in our churches and in our leadership, are falling apart and getting into all kinds of difficulties is because we neglect that very basic. I'm not saying it's a cure-all, but it sure helps to maintain that daily, consistent contact with God and make it a priority, no matter how busy or how scheduled your time is, or how much is going on, that by God's grace, we're going to keep that appointment. Seagulls. The story is told about a flock of seagulls that for many years lived in a small fishing village in Florida. Each day when the shrimp boats returned, the seagulls fed themselves on the discarded shrimp left by the fishermen. One day the shrimp boats moved to another port, and all of that generation of seagulls died. Why? Because that generation had grown up feeding on discards. They had never learned how to obtain food for themselves. This is the plight of many Christians. Unless someone else feeds them, they go unfed. And the food they get is often pre-digested, the result of someone else's studies, or the commentaries, or the Bible dictionaries, or something else. Their feeding period is usually once a week, and that's about as adequate as trying to eat 21 meals on Sunday. Now, I know for many of you this is not a new thought, but I would ask you just to take another long look at your own personal discipline. How has your time with God been? Have other things begun to crowd in? Is it becoming purely academic for preparation, for sermons, for teaching? Or are you truly meeting God on a personal, deep level and experiencing worship and adoration and praise and personal feeding and deepening in your own walk? Is your love for Jesus Christ greater this year than it was last year or 2 years ago? Or are you simply moving in circles and going over the same territory, seeing the same things, and just putting in your time? Let me encourage you to go back over just this one section, developing your ability to hear from God, and make a note to yourself. Is there anything in particular that you saw here that stands out to you? Something you could begin to apply or change? Don't let it become just one more message, one more thing that you can file away when you get home. What by God's grace can you do to put some new life and new zip in your time alone? Or if it's gotten out of hand and you're hit and miss, or it's not happening at all, what can you do to get it back on track? Let me give you just a minute to think and to read over what you wrote down. And then we'll give you an opportunity to ask questions or make comments. Think. Pray. Okay, someone have something you'd like to say? A question, something from your own experience, a comment? Just step to the microphone and... Bob?
We on? Maybe some of us have had the same experience I had. When I was a young Christian, I was very legalistic about quiet time. You know, it was no Bible, no breakfast. But probably for the wrong reasons. Some of us have said, oh, if I don't have my quiet time, I won't have a good day. My car will have a flat tire or something will happen. And then as we grow to understand grace, we realize that God loves us whether we fill out a highlights record or not. And I would just be interested in your thoughts about how to have a healthy discipline or a healthy legalism that gives consistency and yet with good motives.
Okay. Don't strive for perfection, strive for regularity. Set yourself a goal that's not, you know, perfect. I know several leaders that have a goal to have at least 5 mornings a week. Say, well, I'm just, by God's grace, I'm just going to miss a couple. I want to sleep in here or there. But I don't want to have no goal, because then there's a chance I won't get anything in. So rather than going perfection or legalistic, set a reasonable goal that gives you some leeway. God does not get angry with you if you miss a quiet time. You're not going to have a flat tire. That's the concept that the disciples struggled with. You know, when something happened, they assumed, the same as Job's friends, that the reason this bad thing has happened is because this person has obviously offended God. Another concept that has been helpful to me is to make a distinction between climate and weather. The weather is the day-by-day picture, where the climate is the overall general picture of your life. In Palm Springs, where I live, the climate is warm and balmy. But every once in a while, we get a cold front that comes in. And so the weather that particular day is rainy or miserable or windy or cold. But the climate in Palm Springs, generally speaking. So I often, in my own life, try to focus on the climate of my life. If I have a bad day or I miss a day or I even go 2 or 3 days without a quiet time, it doesn't bother me anymore. Because I know that the climate of my life, the general principle of my life, is to get regular time with God. Sometimes things come up and it doesn't happen. So don't get yourself into a legalistic bind. There's a big difference between discipline and legalism. I'm afraid in many quarters the discipline has been misconstrued to mean legalism. We admire great athletes. with their disciplines, with their regimens, with their workout, whether it be a tennis player, a football player, that spend hours and hours looking at game plays and videos and go through all of their exercises and their eating habits and their sleeping habits. Same with a musician. We admire somebody who sits down at the piano and plays so wonderfully. And yet there's a practice that they go through to be able to play like that. Well-known people who do anything well take hours and hours and hours working at it. But you know the interesting thing? I've never heard of anyone referring to an athlete or a musician as being legalistic. But when we take the same principles and apply it to the Christian life, that's legalistic. So I would challenge you, if you're in that area of trying to sort that out, that you do some thinking about what is the difference between biblical discipline and legalism. And when does one become the other? It's easy to poo-poo the whole thing and say, well, I don't want to become legalistic, so I'm not going to set a time, and I'm not going to do this regularly or that regularly because I don't want to become legalistic. So you can become a slob instead. I mean, that's much better, obviously. Seriously, there's a big difference between legalism and discipline. And either sloppiness or legalism can be a trap that you can fall into. Concentrate on the climate and enjoy your quiet time. You're not doing it to please God or earn brownie points or be a good Christian. You're doing it because you want to meet with Him, because you love Him, because you enjoy Him. I don't get together with my wife because I have to, because I want to. I want to develop the relationship. Well, your motives are important. Another comment or question? Eli? Yes, if you can.
Dave, I think many instances, I was brought up understanding the value of my quiet time. And then when I got married, I wanted so dearly for my wife to share those moments with me. How do we, as men, is it important for us to share those times with our wives, especially being in the ministry? And is it a value, and how do you see that happening?
I think we're probably talking about two different things. One is that I think we need our own personal time alone. And in addition to that, it's good to spend time with your spouse if you're married and share. I don't think that a couple having a quiet time or reading our daily bread around the breakfast table can suffice for them. I need to be alone with God by myself. Not to the exclusion of doing it periodically with other people. But then it's good to either get together if you're reading the same thing or to read a devotional around the table. Or my wife and I try to have a date once a week. And I'm very legalistic about that. And during that time together, we pray, we share together, we share what we're reading from our quiet times, and that's the way we get time in the Word together. But when we have our times, it's separate. I don't try to have it together with her. Would anyone else like to respond what you do in your home or with your spouse to accomplish the dual purpose of being alone with God, but at the same time building a spiritual relationship with your spouse? Anyone else on that point like to make a comment? Okay, another question, another comment? Okay, let's move on to the last point. Developing your ability to influence people. Loving. Obviously, you can see a relationship between the three.
Could you help us fill the blanks, please, that last quote about your third point?
Okay, which one was that? Extended time with God? Excuse me. Yeah, let me go back to that point. That's a good one. Appreciate your mentioning that. In addition to those 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever you decide to cut out of your schedule on a daily basis, I think another thing that's very helpful is to get extended time. Once a month, get away for a day, or once a quarter for a couple of days. I was listening to a tape by Jim Detmer, who recently went from Baltimore, where he pastored a church, to join the staff at Willow Creek. And on this tape, he was saying that every month he gets away for 2 or 3 days for extended time alone. Some of us can't carve out 2 or 3 days a month. But try to figure out something. If it's a weekend, a quarter, or a quarter, or a day, a month. But a lengthy time. Not to study and prepare for sermons or to read books, but to spend time with God. Take walks in the woods or down by the beach. Take a Maranatha or Integrity Praise music and just spend some time worshiping and singing. Spend some time in confession and adoration and praying and intercession for people. Just a lengthy quiet time. Now, if you can make a 3-day out of it, that you can spend, you can divide it up into different parts, where you are reading some things of a devotional nature for your own spirit. Reading Tozer, Knowing God by J.I. Packard. Something that just feeds your own soul. I mean, We do that once in a while in our physical lives. You know, we eat our regular routine, but every once in a while we go out to a real nice restaurant and have a feast. It's just something special. It's different. It's above and beyond what we ordinarily do in our eating habits. And so it is in our spiritual eating habits. It's good to go out and do something a little special. And especially it's important to change your routine or your geography. Don't stay at home to try to do it. Go to the mountains or go to the beach or go to the desert or somewhere else where the whole geography changes, because it just gives you fresh eyes. Take long walks. We're so inhibited because we have so much time. It's 15 minutes or 30 minutes and we're kind of blocked in. But just think of the beauty of being able to walk for hours. No schedule. Leave your watch at home. Just make sure you get home after 3 days. You can look at the sun and figure out when one day changes to another. But I think sometimes we need to do something radical like that just to break loose and just spend that extended time with God. So that was the point I missed, and I'm glad you reminded me to go back to that. Okay, the third, developing yourself to your full potential. And what I was saying here is you can see how they're interrelated. If I really am open and a lifelong learner, then I won't be satisfied just doing the same things year after year. I want to break out of my ruts. I want to try something new and fresh. I don't want to keep feeding out of the same stagnant, dirty, rusty old pond. I want fresh streams because I'm a learner and I don't want to get into ruts. Therefore, I want to have new life in my quiet time and think of new things to do. Change it so that it still has life in it. And of course, if you're a lifelong learner, then you're open to learning new ways of relating to people, all kinds of different people. Tom Peters and Stu Leonard. Have any of you read any of Tom Peters' books? He's written three now. Some of you have. One of the people that he refers to quite often is this fellow named Stu Leonard, who has this incredibly interesting market back in the Midwest, where they do like $1 million a week in gross sales. I mean, I'd love to see that place sometime. But they seem to do all the right things. They treat their customers right. They have a suggestion box in the store where they get to the first thing they do every morning before they open the store up is all the employees get together and they go through the suggestion box. And immediately they try to apply what they've heard, make changes. Somebody talked that they didn't have enough ice on the fish. It was kind of getting a little dry. That very morning, they'll put more ice on. If the bread's stale, they'll talk to the baker and have him figure out what's wrong and immediately try to apply it. So you think this guy knows everything about running a business. He's successful. He's done everything right. But because he's a lifelong learner, he decided to go to a training program that Disney World puts on. $3,500 for several days to learn how to run a business. And so shortly after this training program, he bumped into Tom Peters in some context, and Peters had heard that he had gone to this thing, and he was wondering why in the world he would go. You know, he should have been teaching it, not going to it. So he asked Stu this question, and Peters once again exhibiting this desire to learn. He said, "No, well, what was it they told you? I mean, you heard a lot of things, probably some of it you've heard before. Was there some common thread? Was there some key common denominator, some thought that sort of permeated everything they said?" And Stu said, "You bet there was. One thing they kept saying over and over and over, you've got to care about people." Did we hear that this morning here? Isn't that what Bob told us? You have to care. All the computers and all the sermons and all the great Bible lessons will never substitute for having a genuine care and concern for people. John D. Rockefeller said, "I will pay more for the ability to deal with people than any other ability." And he paid quite a bit. Teddy Roosevelt said, "The most important single ingredient in the formula for success is the knack of getting along with people." And I tell you, I'm not that old. I'll be 51 at the end of this year. But one thing I've learned in my contact with people and talking with people from different places is the one thing that dead ends people more than anything else is the inability to develop good personal relationships. More people plateau in their jobs. More people get fired. More people come home from the mission field. More marriages break up. Not because the knowledge wasn't there, or they didn't have the educational credentials, or they didn't know what to do, or they made some tactical or technical error. 9 times out of 10, the problem can be traced to the inability to get along with people. I read some statistics about missionaries that were coming home from the mission field prematurely. Not people that came home, but came home before they were supposed to come home. And it was astounding. Of all of those that came home prematurely, 90% came home because they couldn't get along with their fellow missionaries. More pastors leave churches. More churches split. More people get fired, even in the Christian context, because they don't know how to get along. They can be geniuses, have all the credentials, the PhDs, have everything that they're supposed to have, but if they don't have the simple thing that we're talking about here, the knack of getting along with people, sooner or later it's going to catch up with them. Turn with me to Psalm 78, 72. And I think one of the greatest things that we can do to ensure that we finish well is to develop the skill of influencing people by loving them and caring about them. Psalm 78, verse 72. It's sort of a Polaroid snapshot of King David. And David shepherded them with integrity of heart. With skillful hands, he led them. In that simple verse, I see three qualities in David's life. First of all, I see character. He shepherded them with integrity of heart. Charles Colson was at a meeting in Chicago, and he was asked, what three qualities would you say were important in the life of a Christian leader to be successful? Well, he said the first one would be integrity. And the second one, integrity. And the third essential quality would be, what do you think? Integrity. Here we see David. He shepherded them with integrity of heart. A lot of times that's missing. We shepherd them with the wrong reasons. We use them. And Bob once again referred to this morning. We bring them in to help us reach goals or accomplish the job. But it's not with integrity of heart. So character. Then I see concern and care. He shepherded them. Inherent in the word shepherd is care and concern. In our leadership, it's a matter of shepherding people, of taking care of them. And lastly, I see competence. I see character. I see care. I see competence. He led them not with sloppy hands or so-so hands. He led them with skillful hands. I propose to you that when we see failure in some context of leadership, it's usually not failure in competence. And it doesn't necessarily have to be failure in character, but it can be failure in the idea of caring, truly caring for people, and knowing that we care for them. One of the things, and the next thing on your outline there, that's essential in this is the ability to listen to people. What do you feel like when you're talking with someone, and the whole time that you're talking or conversing, they're looking over here, or they're looking over there, or they're looking up here, or worse yet, when they don't think you're watching, you know, they're kind of glancing out of the corner of their eye at their watch. What does that communicate to you? What are you feeling when you're talking with someone and they're looking everywhere but at you? You're not real important. And what goes through your mind when you see them glancing at their watch? Pardon me? Yeah. I'm going to hurry to get someplace. Would you hurry up and get over with so I can get on with something more important? I'm a real driver. I'm type A personality that should have had a heart attack a number of years ago. By God's grace, He's helped me to slow down. And I generally tend, if I'm not careful and not walking with God, to always be in a hurry. So I have to work at walking slower, talking slower, taking time, listening. So for many years I prayed that God would give me the ability to be a good listener because I'm basically a talker. And I remember one time I had this little prayer journal and I wrote in that prayer journal just a little prayer to myself to listen. One morning when I opened up my prayer journal, right in the middle was something in red. And I looked at it more closely, and in brackets right under listening, my wife had written with a red pen, "with your eyes." And I thought, she's got a lot of nerve. First, taking my private, personal, secret prayer journal, and then writing in it, in red. But you know she's right. As I thought about it over the years, and I've since forgiven her for that, that the most important thing about listening is to look and give eye contact. I have several people that I love to get time with, and I just begin to sort out in my own mind why it is that I love to be with them. And that is, anytime I'm there, it's like I'm the only person in the world. They never look at their watch, you never get the feeling that they're rushing off somewhere, and they're just sitting there, kind of looking at you like everything you're saying, you know, is scripture. And I thought, God, I would, by your grace, like to cultivate the ability to give, and properly so, people the attention that you really are important. That since you and I are standing here talking, nobody else makes any difference. It's just you right now that I'm talking to. And the eyes are the eyes have it. That's the one telltale sign that you're communicating to somebody when you're looking at them and you're talking to them. Not that you're looking down at the ground or you're looking up at the sky. In the last seminar we had yesterday, there was a gentleman in here that when we shared that and he went back over this section, he said, you know, several years ago, and he's a pastor, I was in the church and I was talking to a fellow and he was unburdening his heart to me. And just as he was talking, somebody passed by outside the window and I took my eyes off him and I waved to this person and he stomped out of the room. And then as he was going out the door, he turned around and said to me, you don't really care what I'm sharing with you. And he left. And the pastor, of course, was very disturbed over the whole thing, and he thought, well, what'd I do? As he reflected back, he said, when I took my eyes off of him and focused on this other person and waved, he interpreted that as meaning, I mean, he didn't know what I was waving at because he was looking at me. The person was passing behind him. But that communicated that what I'm saying, it's not registering with you. He said, if only I had looked at him and just kind of went like this but kept the eye contact, it wouldn't have happened. And so he learned a lesson from that, listening. Next one, keep short accounts. Keep short accounts. Don't let something fester. Matthew 5:23-24, if you want to write those verses down. If you know you've offended somebody and it's come to your attention, go and make it right. Leave your gift before the altar. Just this last week before I left on this trip, one of the staff members at the church said, you know, your secretary's experiencing some real tension in her relationship with you. Told me this about 3 or 4 o'clock one afternoon. You know how long I waited? She was already gone by the time I got. You know how long I waited to talk with her? The very next morning, before she even got to work, I left a little note and said, could I just see you for a few minutes before we start work? And when she came in, I just shared honestly, it's come to my attention that I've offended you in some ways. Maybe I've been doing some things. And I shared with her what I'd heard and said, well, what can you tell me? What can we do to make this right? And it was a total misunderstanding. And I apologized to her and asked her what I could do differently not to communicate what I evidently had communicated. She cried. We hugged each other. And it's been great the last couple of weeks. And yet I've been in situations where people would say, well, that's not my problem. If she's got a sensitive spirit, she needs to get it right with God. I've done nothing wrong. My hands are clean. Let her come. And they'll go on for weeks and months. I knew a father and a son-in-law, and both in Christian ministry, they hadn't talked to each other for 2 years because somebody had done something, and neither one of them were willing to go and make it right. I said, well, surely this is very unusual. Don't you bet on it. It happens all the time. Keep short accounts. Praise. Catch people doing something right. Kenneth Blanchard, if he said nothing else in all those books that he wrote, that was a great thought. Catch people doing something right. We grew up in a society that the whole thing is geared to finding something wrong. I mean, when your teacher read your papers in school, was she looking for something right? And when you got the paper back, were you looking for something right? You were looking for what she found wrong, looking for those red marks all over your paper. And sometimes I saw more red marks than I saw my own. And if somebody says to you, Jim, could you come into my office? I'd like to talk to you for a minute. And your first thought is, wow, he's going to give me a raise. He's going to tell me what a wonderful, what's the first thing that goes through your mind? What did I do wrong? And when our kids tuck in your shirt, sit up at the table, do this, do that, straighten up your room, brush your teeth, comb your hair. And instead of concentrating, catch them doing something right. Simple principle, but it works wonders in relationships. I had another a gentleman in here who said, you know, my wife's the secretary at the church. He said, I can't remember when's the last time I walked up and just complimented her, and I just take her for granted. Catch them doing something right. Okay, 4 C's and we're through. We'll give you once again a chance to respond. convictions. Be a person that's true to your convictions. Don't be wishy-washy, namby-pamby. If you feel deeply about something, say it. You don't have to cram it down someone's throat, but say, you know, I really have some strong feelings on this, and I want to express myself honestly. I think people appreciate it when somebody's honest and says, this is what I feel and this is what I think, rather than, you know, you think it and you feel it, but you don't say it. You don't come out and just honestly, openly say it. Say it in love, but say it. Ephesians 4:15 says, speaking the truth in love. If you're loving but not speaking the truth, it's sentimentality. But if you speak the truth and it's not in love, it's brutality. Some people say, well, it's the truth and he's going to hear it. I don't care whether he likes it or not. But that's not what Ephesians 4:15 says. It says, speaking the truth in love. Conflicts. Resolve the conflicts. Somewhat related to short accounts. Compassion. Do it with empathy. There was a father who was at home working on his computer one afternoon, and his son had fallen off the tricycle and he came into the office. He was crying and holding his arm and weeping. And so dad put his pencils and his papers down and wheeled his chair around and asked the boy what had happened. And through his tears, the boy was trying to explain it. And dad wanted the details and so forth and kind of analyzing the whole situation. So finally the kid just turned around and continued to cry, but he walked out to look for his mother. You know, he would really get some response. So mother swept him off of his feet and hugged him and kissed his elbow and so forth. But then she wasn't through because she took the son that went back into the office where the husband was and reading the riot act. So the husband said, well, what can I do? You know, I mean, he came in, I stopped my work, I asked him some questions, tried to show a little attention, tried to find out what happened. You know, what else was I supposed to do? So the wife said, well, at least you could have said, oh. Show some empathy. Just a simple little thing like walking by somebody's desk and say, you know, I can understand how difficult this is. Just a little compassion, a little empathy. Now, that doesn't come natural to me. I'm not an empathetic, emotional person. That's another area. I think I've got more areas that don't come naturally to me than do. That's that I have to pray that God would slow me down enough to walk by and ask people how it's going and keep track when somebody shares a difficult thing so I can come back in a few days and say, well, what's the situation? I've been praying for you. How is that? Lastly, confrontation. Do it immediately. Now, confrontation is different than conflicts. A conflict, you just sort of kind of stumble into, and there you are. You've got a conflict on your hand. But confrontation is that you initiate it. You hear about something that needs somebody to address an issue or to bring it up. And it might not be the most popular thing in the world. But if you prayed about it and you thought through and you do it in a biblical way, confrontation is very important. And don't wait around till it gets itself resolved, because generally speaking, it doesn't. But take initiative and confront. So just some practical things on developing your ability to influence people. As I say, more people that miss it here than any other point. Okay, once again, look back over this section. What do you see here? What have you heard that can be of some help? I'll give you a few seconds to do that. As you can see, I'm application-oriented here. I know you didn't come here to fill up your page and stuff it in your Bible and go home and not be one with the difference. What has God showed you in these three points? What can you do? What can you begin to pray about? Make yourself accountable. That could help you so when you get down to the end of your life, you finish well. That's what we're talking about here. How to finish well. So God can say, well done, good and faithful servant. Be a lifelong learner. Develop your ability to listen and hear from God. Develop your ability to influence people by loving them. Any comments? Anybody like to make questions as we close here? Anybody want to go to lunch? No? Okay. You want to go to lunch? Or you make a comment?
I was just going to say, this one C here, when you talk about convictions, be truthful. I have a tendency a lot of the times to be true to my convictions and express my opinion. And a lot of the times you run into people and say, I don't want to hear that. You know, what's wrong with you? So you have a tendency to swallow the back and say, well, maybe I won't say.
Yeah, when a person of conviction runs into a person who's not teachable, you have a conflict.
Well, I'm the type of a person, I'll back off first, you know, and I think, well, I just won't do what you say. Well, that's not true. So
it's probably not healthy, though. Figure another way, if you can't say it to them, then write it in a memo or write it in a note, but get it out. Yeah, I don't think it's healthy, no. You got a guy, you're going to wind up with a leader with a lot of people around who just say yes sir, three bags full, and pretty soon he goes off the end of the cliff, but because he's never open to have anybody disagree or point out another viewpoint, and it happens all the time. How do you get over,
Well, how does anyone get over that hump of expressing your convictions to someone that's...
You mean when you tend to back off? Well, the best thing you can do is just fire them. Get somebody who's teachable. No, there's no simple answer, okay? Why don't you say it at the mic there? Could you do that? The question is at stake here is if you tend to back off when you express your convictions because you're talking to somebody who's not teachable, how do you overcome that and manage to speak and say what you really feel?
I think you've really helped us too at the point of I don't have to apologize for the Word of God. And to give a case in point, I have a secretary right now, and I've got a conviction, a personal conviction, some deep felt things about soap operas and et cetera, et cetera. Well, during her lunch hour, she's brought a little bitty transistor TV up there so she doesn't miss her favorite soap opera. Well, I'm out during the lunch hour. I'm not there, and I saw the TV there, and in a time or two, I've caught her, and I said, man, how am I going to... I've got a conviction, which she doesn't have. And... sharing with her, I mean, finally one day I've had it up to here. I answered the phone, and somebody on the I stayed over during the lunch hour. I answered the phone, and I was talking to somebody, and she had turned that soap opera thing up, and it was talking about so and so was living with so and so, and this guy and the other. He said, "What's happening in your office?" well, that is, you know, I was praying. Well, I was uneasy about the whole thing. Finally, just to share scripturally. And, you know, if she wanted to take her lunch hour and go do whatever, that was my conviction that it didn't need to ever be in our office. And for the sake of the brethren, she was once I shared scripture with her, then she wasn't really arguing with me. If my convictions are scripturally based, and if she's got a problem, that's between her and the Father. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't apologize for the Word of God. At the same time, I didn't come down hard on her, but we don't have soap operas in the office anymore. You know, so.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming. You've been a delightful group to share with. If any of you want to talk about anything that we've shared this morning, I'm available the rest of the week. Have a great lunch.